Anybody need a lesson 16? All right, so backing up for a second, we're setting this stage here for the questions that we're about to ask for the beginning of 2 Samuel 19. So Absalom usurps the throne of David. All right, so he starts judging the people. He sends spies out. He has them proclaim him all at one time to be the king. He runs David out of town. David leaves hurriedly. He leaves because he's worried about what Absalom would do to him. And you see these people who are willing to come with him. You see the Perites, or I get those names. I butcher the names with it said. the Pethelites, the Gittites, you see the Cherethites. They all go with him, his servants, mighty men. You see these people come with David out. He's being run out of town, essentially, but you see these people who want to stay with David, who are loyal to him. He's being run out of town, you know, a fear of death. They follow him on this, you know, forced march all the way to the River of Jordan. And then when they find out that Absalom's getting ready to come and kill him, they cross over. You know, you've got, I think, 20,000 people died in that battle. Ahithophel wanted to send just 12,000, but you had Hushai convince him to bring all the men from, you know, Dan to Beersheba to face David, and they battle. In this battle, it said over 20,000 men were slaughtered. And then, as you enter the battle, David's concerned about who? Absalom. Don't harm him. Now you've got that Absalom's died, and you have David who is weeping over Absalom. Here he is on the run. He's been, not necessarily exiled, but he's been pushed aside. People have turned on him, except for you think about those people who went with him and were okay with his lot in life. Following David, they were loyal to David. Some of these would have been godly and doing what God would have wanted. And so, ask a question. How did the people respond to David's mourning of Absalom? All right. Humiliated, shamed, turning their victory into mourning. You look at verse 3. So the people went by stealth into the city that day as people who are humiliated steal away when they flee into battle. And that's because in verse 2 it says the victory that day was turned into mourning, for all the people had heard that the king is grieved for his son. All right. You've got, you know, as we talked about setting the stage, how would you feel? Okay, so you've followed David. You fought for David. You're loyal to David. David is the anointed one, but he's the one who's been good to you. You're the one, you're trying to help him in his lot in life. And then this is what happens. You know, I wrote this note. This is, how would you feel if a person that you were loyal to, you admire, you'd fought for, you were willing to die for, and you'd defended through the worst of times, showed at best an indifference to you? Because that's what David was doing. At best, he was showing an indifference to them in the way that he was responding to their victory and Absalom's death. He mourns the loss of a son who not only murdered his other son, he stole the throne from him, he ran him out of town, he slept with his concubines, and then he chased him down to kill him. And here you have David bemoaning and mourning and weeping openly and wished I could have died in his place. How would you feel as a people who'd fought for this man you were loyal to, you wanted to put back in power, whether it be because of your loyalty to David or because you knew that God had anointed him? How do you think they felt? I mean, it tells us here in the text, and it'll lead to what Joab kind of tells him. How would it make you feel? And that's what we're looking at here. What does Joab tell David in verses 5 and 6? Sir?
He had not treated the soldiers right because he was willing to give their lives to defend him.
Yeah, he hadn't treated them right. He says, today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines by loving those who hate you and by hating those who love you. For you have shown today the princes and servants are nothing to you. For I know this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased. He didn't show them the love and respect that they deserved. He essentially turned his back on them in what they had done for him versus his mourning of Absalom. So I ask this question, and you put it in your own words. I've got it in mine. What has David done to these people? Shamed and embarrassed them?
They didn't mean anything to him.
They didn't mean anything, not compared to Absalom.
He showed more concern for Absalom, it seems, than being grateful for those who risked their lives in his behalf.
That's right.
What he shows is David, then our view can be so blinded by our filial love.
Yes. We'll get to that in just a second, because we'll discuss that. He alienated these people. These people who helped you take back the throne. These people who fought for you through thick and thin, through peril, through fear of death. You know, that's what he's done. He's alienated them. And so what does Joab tell him to do, and why? Yeah. Yeah, surely not a man will pass this night with you if he doesn't go out and speak kindly to him. You've alienated him. You pushed him over here. He says, and this will be worse for you than the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now. He is the anointed one. And yet here he is mourning for the loss of his son versus rejoicing in the fact that he has overcome the peril and the usurper and what has happened to him. Now, that being said, I'm not saying that you shouldn't mourn the loss of a loved one. mourn the loss of a loved one who wasn't a Christian or of God. You know, you may have a family member that you love dearly and you're sad that they've passed on. They may not have had a relationship with God. Doesn't mean you can't mourn for yourself. But as Christians, we need to be realistic in the understanding that we have our faith. We have one true God who we put no other above. And though we may mourn for ourselves, that person is going to answer for their actions just like we're going to answer for our actions. And here, there's not a problem with David mourning Absalom. It's the way in which he's mourning Absalom. The way in which he is worried more about him and not worried about the people and what they've done for him. I think about, you know, prioritizing the Absalom over himself. You know, Absalom wasn't a godly man. And here he is. How do people see that? And obviously they're willing to leave him for it if he wasn't to go back and talk to him and discuss with him. Speak kindly to him is what it says. It's interesting to me, because I think this is a kind of a tangent, but it's interesting to me how this all kind of plays out for a second. Something that we can learn, and this is kind of in the background, but I'll bring it up. We know in 2 Samuel 15 that after Absalom was allowed back into the presence of David, it said that he would sit at the gate and he would judge the people, and eventually he stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. And then he sent his spies out, and then he usurped the throne. David's God's anointed. How in the world, because indications are that this was going on in or around Jerusalem, how in the world did Absalom usurp the throne in this way? If David's the leader anointed by God and was doing what he should have been doing, how did Absalom, and this is conjecture to an extent, but if you'll bear with me for a minute, I'll point some things out that I think we need to be mindful of. Whether it's actually what was the downfall of David, I don't know. But, I mean, what are some thoughts on that? How was Absalom able to do that?
David was just coming out of the grave, you know, the sin of Bathsheba.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that he lost a lot of respect in Israel. Or he lost a lot of the hearts. It was a good time, possibly, again, conjecture, mm-hmm. good time for Absalom to step in.
That's possible. We don't know how many people knew about that, but I mean, obviously some do because they knew that Bathsheba had a child. They knew that he had a new wife. You have that. I'm not sure the distance between the time that happened and this, but yeah, that's one reason. Alex?
Absalom was very underhanded and sneaky in how he did this. He would tell some of the people he'd be reading not to tell anybody about this. So I think he just snuck in. He did it all undercover and just caught David by surprise.
Yes, I mean, I'm not going to say that that's not an option, because as much as you may work to try to solidify a nation or do what you're supposed to, doesn't mean people can't undermine you. I agree. What else are your thoughts? Yes, sir.
It's ironic. David's known as a man after God's own heart. Evidently, when he looked at his son Absalom, it appears to me that he loved Absalom so much because of his physical beauty. But Absalom, from his heart standpoint, was a rotten person, a murderer, and all these things. But David couldn't see that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was not looking at the inward, he was looking at the outward, and was persuaded. So, good lesson for us that be careful in that area.
I agree. I'll make a suggestion. It's along the lines of what Rocky said and the other things that are possible. But what struck me on this is twofold. One, unconditional love of your child does not mean you overlook their wrongdoings and their misdeeds. You're not doing them any favors if you're not correcting them in a way that they should be to put them out on the straight and narrow path. Two, David was the king of a nation. We know that he had 10 concubines, he had at least 6 wives. How many kids? I don't know. He's involved in warfare times. He's amassing a nation. Maybe David divided himself too thin. He spread himself too thin. I mean, what kind of a father was he? I mean, maybe he should have been spending more time with his kids and raising them. You see how his kids have turned out. Don't know that for sure, but you wonder how somebody can come in and undermine him so easily. You get so spread thin in your life. And this is just speaking from experience. You start committing to things, you start worrying about things, and you lose track of your priorities. Next thing you know, you feel things kind of slipping away. You feel guilty maybe that you're not spending time with your kids, and so you want to be the fun parent, but you're not disciplining them the way you need to. Things are slipping away when it comes to your job. You just spread yourself so thin that something, if not everything, suffers. And yes, it is conjecture as to what this is, but you see what David had done to himself in spreading himself thin in all these different ways, especially from the family life and the responsibilities, you know, we can allow that to happen. And so I just want to bring that forward as a thought, that we need to be careful that we don't, you know, prioritize. He's God's anointed. Did God give him more than he could handle? No. He was doing what he should have been doing. Would this have all worked out fine? Yes. Some of this may have been the judgment that God gave him when he was disobedient and he committed adultery with Bathsheba. But spreading yourself too thin and not handling the priorities that you need to handle and getting too far out here can cause repercussions in your home life and can cause repercussions in other areas of your life. Todd?
You know, Absalom fled to his grandfather, which his grandfather, his mother's father,
mm-hmm.
was the king of another nation. I'm not clear on how big that other country or city was. So he spent 3 years there. Perhaps he was being trained politically to persuade what like politicians do.
That's possible. He was already it's conjecture. He was already rotten at that point, we know. And there may have been other there's so much to the story we don't know, but from the standpoint of looking at David, where did he go wrong? I just think about, you know, he spread himself thin, he started making some poor choices, not putting God first. And then when it came time to handle his business with his family, he didn't handle his business with his family. He didn't correct Amnon when it happened. Should have put him to death. I think that would have sent a message to the rest of his family. He didn't defend Tamar. You know, you think about how that affected her, not standing up for her and doing what's right for her. And then here you have Absalom. He's absolving him of the murder, bringing him back. And then now he takes his throne away. And then here he is. He's still mourning the loss of him so much so that he's alienating the followers. You know, we've got to be careful that we're doing what God would have us to do and treating our kids the way they should be treated. If we're not spending the time and pouring into them, whether it be in our kids or our work, and I'm talking kids now because of Absalom, you know, you can't just gloss over their, you can forgive and you can teach, but you can't just gloss over the bad things that they do. You need to correct it. And if he wasn't involved in their lives, he couldn't correct it. It's just interesting to me, and this is for another time. Look for a positive male role model as far as a dad goes in the Bible. I think about that and get with me. This is in my recollections. Find a good father figure in the Bible. I mean, there are going to be men who are going to have had some downfalls and everything, but I struggle to find a man who really was a great father figure outside of God. Raised his kids in the way that they should be raised. And I'm just, if I'm wrong, point it out to me. But it's interesting to me that God is that person that you can look to at unconditional love for his kids and continue to reprimand them and continue to love them. I don't see that with Samuel, who was a godly man, or David, or some of these other men that you think of that you revere, and had a lot of great faith. Just that's an aside. Anyway, moving on.
Keith,
yes, ma'am.
I also see, again, conjecture, but I also see how a parent showing favoritism towards their children,
mm-hmm.
one child over another, or whatever, however many children you have, and can do rivalries.
Yes. Yeah. You.
And that's kind of splattered through.
The favoritism aspect of it. I don't know or understand why David would have favored Absalom. Rocky mentioned looks. I don't know, older son. I don't understand that. You're going to love your kids differently, but it always should be unconditionally in the way that God intended you to. I love my daughter different than I love my son, but I love them equal amounts. You just love them in different ways. My daughter likes more of tender love and affection. My son likes me to wrestle with them, and that's the way we show our affection for one another. We love each other differently, but equally. You can't show favoritism because of what it could do. You shouldn't show favoritism because that's not what God would have you to do. Moving on. So 2 Samuel 9, we're getting starting in verse 8, we're going to talk about David being restored as king. So what's being discussed in verses 8 through 14?
The king getting the people to accept him as king.
The king getting the people to accept him as king, the phrasing you see in 10, 11, 12, and 14 is the idea of bring the king back. Now we're going to kind of understand a little bit more the extent to which that Absalom had usurped the throne of David. So here in this context, it's talking about all the people, verse 9, are quarreling throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, the king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hand of the Philistines, but now he has fled out of the land of Absalom. However, Absalom, whom we anointed over us, has died in battle. Now then, why are you silent about bringing the king back? So there, now there's this discussion of bringing David back as king. I'd mentioned in last class, you know, did Absalom become king and then was he killed, or did he usurp some of the power? But he never was a ruling king or reigned. He took the position over. We see it here. The people say that they anointed him king. And to that effect, I'll ask this. Using the following verses I gave to you, who was aligned with Absalom during his reign as king in a brief period of time? I heard your mouth it. Would all Israel. All Israel meaning what? Northern? Or northern and southern? Ma'am?
Not Judah.
Not Judah?
Well, there's a division.
There is a division, but they all didn't accept him as king.
Israel accepted
Absalom. So did Judah.
You'll see that. All the people refer to Israel, and then later there's Judah, and then later they quarrel about it. In fact, at the end of the chapter, that tells Judah, well, why didn't y'all ask us?
I would suggest that Judah didn't. Well, I would suggest Judah didn't accept him as king either. Look at verse 11. Then King David sent to Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, saying, speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back? This idea of all, I went through this and I could be wrong. So I was really wondering how this would play out. But I gave verses, and one verse I didn't put on there was 2 Samuel 5:12. Look over at 2 Samuel 5:12 for a second. It says in verse 12 of 2 Samuel 5, then David realized the Lord had established him as king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people, Israel. All right, then you continue on to 2 Samuel 7, 10 and 11. I will also, it says in 2 Samuel 7, 10 and 11, I will also appoint a place for my people Israel and will plant them, and they may live in their own place and not be disturbed again, nor will they the wicked afflict them any more as formerly, even from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and I will give you rest from all your enemies. The Lord also declares to you that the Lord will make a house for you. The verses I gave, and so my suggestion is, it continues to say, it continues to say all the tribes of Israel. Israel is a nation. Judah, they're united. We see divisions amongst the northern, we see divisions, but right now they're called the United Kingdom. And so I would suggest to you that there's an argument on who's going to take David back first. Now, I'd be open to that. But that's what I'm seeing. If it says in 15:10, but Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, and then you see this continuing on through, let's see. It continues on and says these things, and then we see this division where Judah is the last people to bring the king back. I would say that Absalom took control of the entire nation, not just Israel. Maybe I'm wrong on that. But that, and I will say this, it took a lot of study to figure out what they're talking about, because they are one kingdom. We're talking about it. They're the United Kingdom. So is it Israel as a whole, or is it Israel and Judah? And that's, I'll leave that up to y'all, I guess. I mean, that's for y'all. I would suggest to you that no, I think there's a division amongst the two. But why would David ask that question about bringing them back? Now I'm open to more commentary on that, not commentary. I'll need to look at it. I asked the question because I was confused at this. I mean, you get to this point, and the nation is considered the 12 tribes of Israel. And so I brought that out for the fact that it's important to understand why that, because now we're going to have a division. And that may be a better way to explain the division. I bring that up because of this bickering that we have going back and forth. So I'll stick with four now. Like I said, I'll stick with four now. That I think that they were all, but I mean, that is a good way to look at it, looking at the pronouns and what's being discussed. But as we move forward, so you have this idea of bringing David back to being king. I asked the question, who was the last to bring him back? Who was the last to bring him back? Judah. It says in verse 14, thus he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah as one man, so that they sent word to the king saying, return you and all your servants. It may have been the elders that he needed to bring them back, but he needed to convince the nation too. They would be the messenger. They would be your go-between in a sense. But it is the elders, but it's the people in general. He tells them to speak to the elders because the elders have sway over them. But you've got to convince the nation. And so you've got to bring everybody back. So I'm not going to say that the elders are wrong. But he's got to convince the entire nation to come back to him. And the elders would be the people who could help do that. But what concession or agreement did David make in being brought back and trying to unite the kingdom again. I hear anything.
He made Amasa commander of the army.
And that some of these questions are written just because we see these things play out on kind of the small screen. Like, we're going to see immediate things happen because of that. And so it's interesting, like I said before, we just talked about a lot of these names. We name dropped so we could understand who people are, so that we're going to see them come back into our story. So that's what he did. He said to Amasa in verse 13, "Are you not my bone and my flesh? May God do so to me and more also if you will not be my commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab." This is also, keep in your mind who Joab is, because we're going to learn more about him as we go through, not just here, but as we get further on in the study of the United Kingdom. All right, so verse 14, it says that he turned the hearts of the men of Judah, and they said, "Return, you and all your servants." And so David starts to return and asks the question, who had to eat his words and was spared in this context? That's my phrasing. Shimei. So, you know, Shimei was cursing David as he left, and David spared him. And the cursing itself wasn't correct. In 16:7, it says, "Then Shimei said, when he cursed, 'Get out and get out, you man of bloodshed and worthless fellow. The Lord has returned upon you all the bloodshed of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned, and the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom." That's not what had happened. To return the house to Saul, it was Absalom who's reigning now. But David was humbled in doing so, because he says in verse 10, if he curses and if the Lord has told him to curse David, then who shall say, why have you done this so? Idea is it was to humble him. So now here you've got him hat in hand coming back. He hurries down, verse 16 of 2 Samuel 19, and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. And crossing the ford, he fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan, and let the Lord consider me guilty, not remember what your servant did wrong with on the day when my Lord the king came out of Jerusalem, so that the king would take it to heart. For your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I come today, the first of all the house of Joseph, to go to meet my Lord the king. He comes back and he tells him he's sinned. He's humbling himself, leaving him at the mercy of the king. Got to be careful what we say. Be careful we're not too quick to judge. Understand what's going on. We're going to learn more about him in future lessons. Who comes to meet David in verse 24? Did you say? Mephibosheth. All right. And why didn't he go with David? So we have this Mephibosheth now coming to David. Why didn't he go with David? Is there a reason why he didn't go with David?
Ziba.
That's what he's blaming, right? What does he say about it? Sorry, I'm full. We don't. We'll get into that. That's kind of the point of this. We've been emailing behind the scenes. I'm gonna read a different translation and. Just so this was confusing, so I looked at a bunch of different translations. I also looked up the word deceived here. But I'm going to read from the NIV for a second, just to maybe get a little bit better understanding or thought. In this, here it says, verse 26, he said, "My lord the king, since I am your servant and I am lame, I said, I will have my donkey saddled and will ride on it so I can go with the king. But Ziba, my servant, betrayed me." It says he deceived him or betrayed him. The idea is that he was going to go, but Ziba betrayed him, and now he's slandering him. He comes and he hasn't shaved his mustache and he hadn't taken care of his feet. Okay, that's all fine and good, but Ziba's just one servant, correct? This is the interesting part of all this, because of how David judges. See, if you work backward, David splits the land between Ziba and Mephibosheth. Why? Well, let me ask you a question. How many servants did Mephibosheth have? He had Ziba and then Ziba's 15 sons and then all their servants. I think there was 20 servants. Was Ziba the only one that could have saddled him a donkey and he could have gone with him? There's some holes there. I put in here, you know, this idea of deceived is figuratively to delude or to betray. You see that, you know, there's this idea that he slanders him, but maybe there was a hint of truth. You know, Ziba slanders him, supposedly slanders him. He says, today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me. That's what Ziba claims that Mephibosheth said. Maybe he's just sitting back and letting this kind of play out. You know, I put, is there more to this story? So Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants, and these were given over to Mephibosheth. So if I'm David, I'm thinking, well, you couldn't have gotten somebody else to saddle your donkey? Could he have not gotten another servant to saddle a donkey so that he could go with David? I also think about from Ziba's standpoint, did Ziba just make himself look good, you know? Maybe that's the case. Maybe Mephibosheth just couldn't go. And maybe Ziba's making himself look good by betraying him and going over and, look, give me the praise because I brought all this food to you. Or what looks to me like is there's a little bit of politicking and drama going on. Not to know for sure, maybe that's why David did what he did, but it's interesting. There's some excuses made by Mephibosheth. David obviously wants to know, why didn't you go? And then he's already awarded Ziba the, you know, all the land. And now he splits it. But yeah, it's everything above board here. Maybe Ziba was trying to make himself look good in the eyes of David so he could be exalted. Maybe Mephibosheth was seeing how things would play out so that maybe he would be exalted again or gain more or gain prestige. It's just, it's an interesting story. I wouldn't always take this what Mephibosheth said at face value, because in verse
30, that
Ziba. Wouldn't you say that if you kind of hung back and were like, maybe I'm gonna get my spot back, maybe I'm attached to my head, and so you can have what I got? Because to me, there's this kind of idea of taking things at face value. What David said, so the king said to him, why do you still speak of your affairs? I've decided you and Ziba shall divide the land. Hey, look, I'm not sure who's telling me what and what's right. What's true. We're just going to divide it out. But Mephibosheth's the one who did go, and he's the one who is being slandered. But it seems like there may could be a little bit more to that story. Just an aside to what's going on here. Who is bickering in verses 40 through 43? Israel and Judah. And so we see that they're bickering back and forth about David and bringing him back and their parts in David and that sort of thing. And then you hit chapter 20. So who is Sheba and who did he turn away from David? He is a worthless fellow. He's a Benjamite. And so we have no portion in David's, nor do we have an inheritance in the son of Jesse. So every man to his tent, so Israel. And so, hey, we're gone. And so he does. He withdraws and the men leave. So what's David's counsel about Sheba in verse 6?
That he would do more harm than
Absalom. He's not recognizing David as the anointed king. And this would be something that I feel like maybe plays into, this is again conjecture, but maybe plays into the idea that the entire kingdom had left. But now he split the nation. Maybe this is what split, you know, he's splitting the nation now. All right, well, you know what? Israel's going to go home then, and Judah can have David. You know, maybe they were split before, I don't know. But with Absalom, if Absalom was reigning over the entire kingdom, at least the kingdom wouldn't split. It was still together, versus Sheba maybe splitting it. I'm not exactly sure, but he says that he can do more harm than Absalom did. So what happened to Amasa? And this is, you know, so we understand what happens to some of these smaller names.
Joab kills him.
So Joab continues to find a way to remain the commander of the army. He continues to have David's ear, but he's not that great of a man. And we're going to see that he kind of gets his comeuppance later on. So Sheba revolts against David. And so you have this battle going on. So I put, where is Sheba besieged at, and what were Joab's men doing? Sure. Yeah, that's great. I'm glad you said it, not me. I'd taken Abel. I was Abel. That's right. They were. But, you know, it's interesting what we see here. What did the woman at Abel point out, and what agreement was struck?
We'll throw his head over the wall and go
away. That's right. Look at verse 19. If I am of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel, you are seeking to destroy a city, even a mother in Israel, why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord? So verse 21 says, and such is not the case, but a man from the hill country of Ephraim, Sheba the son of Bichri by name, has lifted his hand against David, King David. Only hand him over, and I will depart from the city. And the woman said to Joab, behold, his head will be thrown to you over the wall. So though Israel had rebelled from David, there were still men, people who were loyal, and that's what they did. They threw his head over the wall. And so, yes, sir. I completely agree. Another example of a woman keeping her head or being more level-headed and aware than men in a certain circumstance or situation. So as we continue the story, and so this 19 through 21 has just been kind of progressing as a story for us here. We get into chapter 21. So why was there a famine in the land? And look at, I'll read verse 1 and 2, and it says, now there was a famine in the land, a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year, and David sought the presence of the Lord. And the Lord said, it is for Saul and his bloody house because he put the Gibeonites to death. So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not sons of Israel, but of the remnants of the Amorites, and the sons of Israel made a covenant with them, but Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the sons of Israel and Judah. He had broken the covenant. And so, That's we don't read about it anywhere else. This is just something, again, we're progressing a story of David and what's going on in his life as he continues as the king of the nation. And so, what did the Gibeonites want for atonement?
7 men from the sons of Saul.
They didn't want a bunch of other stuff. They didn't. It says there, we have no concern of silver or gold with Saul or his house, nor is it for us to put any man to death in Israel. They just wanted these 7 men. Mephibosheth is spared. Why is he spared? And we see that come up again. David's promise to Jonathan, and that's why he's spared. Who is Rizpah, and what did David do for her? She was Saul's concubine. She came up in the story before with Abner. That's what caused, you know, the combining of the two nations. You know, that was kind of the beginning of the end. Abner had put in Ishbosheth as the king of Israel. And when Ishbosheth questioned or condemned Abner for supposedly sleeping with Rizpah, that kind of led to the beginning of the end and the nations becoming together. Now she comes up again and her son dies. And what did David do for her? Yes, they are. He showed her some respect, you know, understanding the circumstance and situation. You know, so it says, and then verse 12, then David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan, his son, from the men of Jabesh Gilead, who had stolen them from the open square. And he brought the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan, his son, from there. And they gathered the bones of those who had been hanged. And they buried the bones of Saul and Jonathan, his son, in the country of Benjamin and Zil, in the grave of Kish, his father. So thus they did all the king commanded. And after that, God was moved by the prayer for the land. And so, this is, kind of comes full circle again from the standpoint of we see people and they reappear in the story. But he did right by her in that.
Hey,
Yes, sir.
So they killed seven sons, and if you count it, it's the five sons, and then two sons of Rizpah, and one of them's Mephibosheth.
Different Mephibosheth. So that's because Rizpah was a concubine of Saul, and it's her son. Mephibosheth that was spared is Jonathan's. I looked that up too because I was confused as the Mephibosheths. You would think, you know, I didn't know that was such a popular name then. I mean, can you imagine there being a bunch of Mephibosheths now? And so, but that's how that played out. All right, we've got a couple of minutes. So this is like this class has been kind of progressing our story. So David's back as king. There's kind of been a fuss as to how he's gotten there. We've gotten some smaller stories along the way that have kind of progressed our story, and then we get to this the end part right here. Starting about verse 15. It says, "Now when the Philistines were at war again with Israel, David went down with and his servants with him, and as they fought against the Philistines, David became weary." And so I asked, what happened to David?
The giants were focusing on trying the giants, which were sons of Goliath, were seeking to really get revenge and kill specifically David.
Mm-hmm. So they were trying to kill him, but what's happened to David?
He's getting tired.
Getting tired. What's something else going on?
Old.
There he is, getting old. Y'all gotta read my mind. David's getting old. We're kind of tapering towards the end of his reign, and we see that David's kind of past that heyday where he could go out and fight with the mighty men. He's getting old. And you see here in verse 17, "You shall not go out again with us to battle, so that you do not extinguish the lamp of Israel." We're putting David out to pasture as far as a warrior, as far as battling in that way. We also see, and it's interesting, you know, I won't bring it up. I left it in here just because you think about it. You've got four Philistine men who are described here and different attributes and different things about them. But it's amazing to me as you think about these men. You know, there was one with six fingers on each hand and six toes. But the size of these men, you know, thinking that they're, you know, 8 and 9 feet tall, and the fact that these men are fighting against them. You know, one of them, the shaft of whose spear was like the weaver's beam. That's harkening back to Goliath and just different things. It's amazing to me, even in this time, you know, that they're dealing with those size and those type of people. But with God on their side, they can conquer everything. But it's, you know, sometimes it's hard to relate or just imagine the adversities they faced, but God allowed them to overcome. And can you imagine, you know, I'm 5'8", Neil's 6'4", 6'5". I can't imagine, you know, I'm only a foot shorter, and he looks like he dwarfs me, and then imagine somebody 3 foot taller than Neil back there, you know. And so, you know, but can accomplish anything through God if they're willing to be obedient to him. It's just, to me, it was an interesting story, the things we tell our kids, you know, like the David and Goliath thing. So, all right, that's the end of class tonight. We'll start on lesson 17 on Sunday. Thank you.